This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, in for Terry Gross. We're going to look back to the time when scientists were just discovering the function of the brain through very primitive experimental brain surgery. Carl Zimmer is the author of the book Soul Made Flesh, The Discovery of the Brain and How It Changed the World. It's just out in paperback. It focuses on the work of Thomas Willis, one of the fathers of neurology, who began his surgical investigations into the brain in 1662. This was a time when many scientists were also alchemists, a time when many scientists believed that the soul was located in the liver and heart, a time when a scientist could be put to death if his work challenged the teachings of the church. Carl Zimmer spoke with Terry Gross early last year. In the mid-1600s, when Willis was beginning his research, scientists believed that the heart was the center of thought, perception, and action. Scientists didn't yet know about the existence of nerves and didn't understand the importance of the brain.
The brain as we think of it, the brain as this 3 pounds of flesh, brain that we know as being billions of neurons that are trading signals and chemicals, no one knew the brain as being such a thing. The funny thing is that the one thing in the head that they were struck by were these little holes in the brain. If you were to cut off the top of someone's head and look in their head, you would see a few kind of squiggly little recesses right at the core of the brain. And so people started imagining that these must be very important, that they were sort of called ventricles. And they had this idea that in life they were expanded to be these beautiful vaulted spheres and that spirits would rush through them. And these were spirits that you would actually breathe in from the air. In a sense, you were sort of breathing in part of the world's soul, and it became the spirits that would flow through your body. And they would go through these chambers, these ventricles, and then on their way into the rest of the body. But the brain itself, no one cared about.
Your book focuses on the research of Thomas Willis, who was a scientist in the 1600s, and who you consider the father, I guess people in the field consider him the father of neurology. When he started to investigate the brain, what was the current theory at the time of intelligence and perception?
You can get some interesting insights into what people thought about the mind and intelligence and the brain and so on by looking at contemporary sources like Shakespeare, for example. Or if you look at the journals of 17th century doctors, you get some interesting ideas. So intelligence really wasn't a factor then. I mean, people didn't talk about IQ. They didn't really even talk about idiocy versus intelligence. It just wasn't sort of on their radar. They saw people as being these combinations of humors, these strange substances like black bile and yellow bile, choler, phlegm. And when these got out of balance, they would alter a person's temperament. So we think of personality as being this thing that is the product of our brains and the way that our brains work and the way that the neurons are exchanging chemicals. No one had any sort of concept like this. So Thomas Willis was steeped in all these sorts of ideas. I mean, and so as a young doctor, he would try to apply them. He would try to apply the ideas of ancient doctors like Galen, for example, because that's what he had been taught. But there were just a lot of other ideas kind of roaming around at the time that were challenging this conventional wisdom, so that he began to wonder, for example, if I am treating an hysterical woman, a woman with hysteria, is it really the case that her womb is rising up in her belly, which is what Galen and everyone else believed? Or is there some other explanation that I should be looking for?
Thomas Willis was part alchemist and part physician. What did it mean to be an alchemist in the 1600s?
Well, alchemists were not really the sort of stereotype we have of them today as being from the bad old days before real science got started. They were investigating nature. They were doing experiments. They were trying to understand what matter was made of. And there was actually a long tradition of using alchemy for medicine, to trying to figure out how to create drugs that could transform the body in the same way the Philosopher's Stone was supposed to transform lead into gold. And so this was not something that Thomas Willis would learn in his lectures at Oxford. They were being taught the conventional wisdom from Galen and Aristotle and the other Greeks. But on the side, he was working for a woman who was a sort of a home doctor of sorts, and he was having to make these medicines based on alchemy. And so that got him interested in the whole concept, which helped to make him think about the body not as the four humors, whatever that means, but as sort of a place where chemical reactions took place. And so he wanted to know what were the chemicals that made up the body. Ultimately, his question became, what are the chemicals that make up the brain?
He performed a lot of surgery on corpses to remove and study the brain. What are some of the things that struck him most when he first saw a whole brain?
He was very impressed by it as a very elegant device. People were starting to think of the body as a machine, but no one really thought of the brain as a machine because it tended to look like just a lot of mush. But with his methods, he was able to appreciate just how intricately put together it is, how many different parts it actually has, how the blood vessels creep around to every little nook and cranny in the brain. He called it a curious quilted ball. And he also realized that these ventricles that had dominated our understanding of the anatomy of the head and were supposed to be where these spirits were, that had dominated our thinking for 1,000 years or more, that they were just empty holes, that they had nothing to do with the business of the soul.
Now, he also did a lot of experiments on animals. Dogs, for instance. What are some of the experiments he did on the brains of dogs?
One of the great ideas that Thomas Willis had was that different parts of the brain are responsible for different functions of the body, that you could actually look at a part of the brain and say, this is responsible for doing one thing, this is responsible for doing another thing over here. This is really where all modern neuroscience comes from, trying to parcel up the brain and figuring out its anatomy to figure out what it does. And so he was the first person to really talk about that, but he had to prove it. One of the things that he did was he did an experiment on a dog to show that one part of the brain near the base was responsible for kind of our involuntary functions, like the beating of our heart or the breathing of our lungs, whereas our voluntary motions and our thoughts were going on elsewhere. So what he did, and this is quite a grisly experiment, he would open up a dog's skull, he would damage part of the brain near the base, and then stitch the dog up and see what happened. Well, the dog suffered a pretty horrible death. Fortunately, not all of his experiments were quite as gruesome. He was able, for example, to show that there was this elegant network of blood vessels that supplied the brain with blood, and that you could, even if you cut off one artery going to the head, the others could compensate. And so he did this with a dog, and the dog, he reported afterwards, would follow him around the town as he went to visit his patients, was perfectly happy. And this was further proof to him that the brain was this wonderfully constructed device that had this essential supply of blood given to it in order to work.
Before Thomas Willis, the popular theories were that spirits or the humors affected, you know, intelligence and emotion. Did Willis end up believing that there was still some role for spirits in the body?
Thomas Willis kept on talking about spirits, but what he was talking about when he said spirits was something very different from what came even a century before. In the Renaissance, people believed that there were lots of different spirits in the body. There were vital spirits coming out of the heart and other spirits coming out of the liver. They're responsible for your desires and your appetites. And the animal spirits that were in these ventricles. Not only that, but there were souls in everything around us. There were souls in plants and in the sky. And there were spirits moving around, sort of enacting their will. And what Thomas Willis did was he took all those ideas and made them mechanical, made them chemical. He said, yes, there are spirits, but all they are special kind of corpuscles, he called them. You could think of them as molecules or atoms or some sort of information-bearing thing. And in this way, he was really part of the scientific revolution, which was trying to take these mystical souls out of nature.
The soul was really the province of the church. How did his research and his theories affect the religious teachings of his time?
Well, what happened was that the church started backing away from insanity in a sense that it was no longer considered a matter for the church. The church would often accuse, for example, Quakers of being fanatics, of you know, just being nuts. And, you know, they were, the Quakers at the time were doing some pretty radical things, like walking around naked in the streets to jolt people out of their complacency. But after Thomas Willis started sort of explaining human nature according to the brain, the church started to say, well, these people just must have, you know, disordered brains, and we just need to send them to the doctors. And so this was a real fundamental shift that occurred. And remarkably, the church that had been so disturbed by the implications of the scientific revolution through Thomas Willis ended up embracing one of the central parts of it.
Were there things that the church had seen as demonic possession that it started to see as a disorder of the brain?
Yes, absolutely. Epilepsy, for example, had for centuries been considered a sign of possession. Nightmares had as well. How else to explain how someone could close their eyes and feel that they were being transported to some distant place? Or how could you explain how someone would start raving and screaming and foaming at the mouth? There must be demons. Thomas Willis looked very carefully at these explanations, and he said, I don't think so. And he used his new kind of neurology to say epilepsy is really just a chemical imbalance. It's the explosions that normally happen in a very orderly way in the body getting out of control, so that you're having sort of a kind of a wildfire of the mind, as it were. And so the church would back away from these sort of disorders, saying, okay, well, these too are the province of medicine. They're not for the church anymore.
When did Willis's ideas about the brain start to catch on?
Surprisingly, they caught on really fast. A lot of scientists have had to suffer for years in obscurity before they really grab the attention of their society. But Thomas Willis's first book about the brain, it's called The Anatomy of the Brain, came out in 1664, and it was an immediate hit. It went through 4 editions in the first year. I think it went through about 20 editions all told. It was being published well into the 1800s. And his illustrations, which were done by Christopher Wren, you could still see in textbooks in the 20th century. So these ideas took hold immediately, not just his ideas about how the brain was structured or how the brain worked, but his ideas about the soul and about diseases of the soul and of the brain. It's probably a sign of how ready society was for an explanation like his. The scientific revolution had been going on for quite a while at that point, and people were starting to be able to accept these ideas. And so he just came along at the right time and was smart enough to put all these things together.
When Thomas Willis died, did he donate his own brain to science?
There's no record of that.
I just really wonder if he would have wanted his skull cut open and investigated after death.
I'm sure he would have been happy for someone to look at his brain.
He probably would have wanted to do it himself. I bet he was.
He would have loved to have known what it looked like.
Yeah. So, thank you. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, well, thanks. It's been a real pleasure.
Carl Zimmer speaking with Terry Gross in 2004. His book, Soul Made Flesh, The Discovery of the Brain and How It Changed the World, is just out in paperback.